Now, I'd like you to look at this psalm with me. I think probably most everyone in this room is familiar with this psalm, not as much familiar with it probably as Psalm 23 or maybe a few of the other psalms, but I think probably that all of us would say that this is one of the most familiar of all of the psalms to us. And what we seem to have here is almost an exclamatory interjection where the writer is observing and he says, oh, the blessedness of. And the word blessed could be even translated, oh, the happiness of. Oh, the bliss of. And the multiple blessings of. And the multiple reasons for happiness and bliss of the man who walks according to the way that he describes it. Here is, we know from inspiration, the voice of God. We know that whatever is here, whatever is recorded, that God himself is speaking. Whether David or one of the other writers that are highlighted in this book wrote this, or whether an unknown to all of the scriptures wrote it, the fact that we find it in the Bible tells us that this psalm is inspired of God. And so in a sense, we can say that God himself is saying this. That God himself, and if anyone knows this truth, it is God. And here, no doubt, is the voice of observation. The man who does say this under the inspiration of God. That he is a man, in a sense, he's standing back and he's looking at the godly man and he's looking at the ungodly man. And as he considers the godly man and the ungodly man, it leads him to exclaim, oh, the blessedness of this particular man. No doubt, this is the voice of spiritual experience that speaks. Here is a person who not only observes, but that over a period of time, he has seen this, he's witnessed it, perhaps. He speaks from his own heart, that he observes his own life, that he has followed the Lord long enough to see the influence of the Lord in his own life, the influence of the Word of God, the influence of the kind of life that he describes. And he says, oh, the blessedness of the person that walks not in the counsel of the ungodly. I think every true believer can observe this, but you who have followed the Lord over a period of time, surely you feel that way. Surely you do not find yourself looking at the world and envying the world and its ways, or thinking about how much fun the world has. But truly, surely the voice of experience has taught you that the real blessed life, the life of bliss, the life of true happiness is found in what you observe in this psalm. And we don't stand and wish that we could do what the folks of the world do. But we know that the voice of experience teaches us that we have truly found what they are looking for. And so here is the voice of observation, the voice of spiritual experience. It's the voice really of reason. All who look at life truly should come to this, that it's just reasonable. If you look at things objectively, if you look at things truthfully, it reasons out that you're going to be better long term in life to follow the path of this psalm. In fact, it is unreasonable to follow the other path. I am often reminded of how the Bible, Jesus spoke of the prodigal son. And when the prodigal son's life began to turn around, remember what the Bible said? He came to himself. And you get the idea that here is a man, here is a young fellow that has squandered everything. And the truth is that there's been almost an insanity to his life. Almost a foolishness where he had lost his reason. And sometimes when you look at people and you look at the path of their life, you think, surely if you just observe, if you observe life and you observe what you see, you will choose a better path. It is the voice of reason. But the Bible makes it very clear that the natural man's reason is messed up. That he does not see things clearly. That he walks about in spiritual blindness and the vanity of his mind. And he's held captive by Satan's deceptions. And he does not see things clearly. That's the problem. And the Bible speaks of truth as being light. And as the truth is spoken and as a man sees it by the Spirit, all of a sudden light comes and he can see that I have lived a foolish way. I have chose a life of moral or spiritual insanity. And now I'm going to choose this other way. So here's a voice of reason. There is no question but man is in pursuit of this happiness. That people in life are in pursuit of happiness. A man may make the pursuit of his life wealth. He may make the pursuit of his life great accomplishments. He may make the pursuit of his life learning. Or he may make the pursuit of his life pleasure. And these are the things that drives him and moves him. But underlying that is but one thing. Underlying the pursuit of knowledge and underlying the pursuit of things and underlying the pursuit of knowledge and all of the other things that a man may pursue, what a man is pursuing is happiness. That what drives a man to work as he does, to put in the hours that he does, is happiness. What drives a person to live in a certain neighborhood or to drive a certain vehicle or to go to a certain place in life, it's the pursuit. That people are in pursuit of happiness in their life. They most follow the path of the writer of Ecclesiastes, who sought for happiness. He sought for meaning of life. He had the options in front of him because he had the possibilities that wealth could give. He had the possibilities that experience in all realms of life could give him. And so he looked to pleasure and he found emptiness. He looked to accomplishments and the writer of Ecclesiastes found emptiness. He looked to learning and he found emptiness. He looked to materialism, to wealth, to gain. And he began to think that I spend my life to gain all of these things and my son may be a fool and he loses it all. And in the end, he found that all of that was vanity, vexation. And he said, I hated life. He's like so many people today that finally in the end take their own lives. Or resolve themselves to a life of misery and unhappiness. And not only are they unhappy, but everybody else is around them is unhappy. And the reality is they hate life. Thankfully, the writer of Ecclesiastes, he did find it. He talked about it. He talked about enjoying the life that God has given you. And he talked about enjoying your labor and the fruit of labor. To enjoy the life as it comes, but in all things, to fear God, to keep His commandments, to remember that you're accountable to God and live your life that way. Well, I say many have given up completely on the pursuit of happiness. And many have sought it through alcohol, they've sought it through drugs, they've sought it through another wife or through another husband, they've sought it in so many different ways, and we're watching. We're watching as the taking of one's own life becomes more and more prominent, even among youth and children, and moms and dads, and our elderly people, in fact. And it kind of amazes us, doesn't it? That people in the latter years of their life would finally say they haven't found what they're looking for. They haven't found it. Now, the Bible purports to show the way of happiness. The Bible is a book that openly declares that a person can be happy, that there is a life of bliss. And the Bible purports to show us that way, to show us the path up to that way. Now, many people claim to have the answer to happiness, that's for sure. But it can be tested. And time tests everything, doesn't it? Time tests whatever people think, whatever people say, whatever they bring before us. Time proves it. Time has a way of rolling on and rolling over men's ideas and men's thoughts. But here is the book. Jesus himself said, and one of the great statements he made, in John 10:10, I am come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. I am come that you might have life and that you might live it to its very maximum, that you may understand life in its fullness. Basically, he said, I am come that you might have life as God designed for it to be. I am come, I understand the miseries. He says the thief has come to kill and to destroy. And he's talking about Satan in that verse, and how Satan has ruined and destroyed people's lives. But he said, I've come that you might have life and that you might have it more abundantly. And so he is showing that there is a way, and he has come to bring light to that way. And we know that from Matthew chapter 5, he taught those great beatitudes. Blessed are those that mourn, and blessed are those that are poor in spirit, and blessed are those that hunger and thirst after righteousness. Blessed are the pure in heart. Those, you know them. Many of you have them on your kitchen wall somewhere, or a wall in your house. And he's saying that the happy man, the blessed man, is a person that finds life this way. And of course, that goes against how the world looks at it. Now, here in this text, the Bible describes the blessed man. Blessed is the man. Oh, how blessed, how bliss is the life of the man that's described here. Now, you notice that in describing this man, he describes this man according to what he does and according to what he does not do. And his happiness is connected to his actions or his doings, his life. I would like to emphasize that so much. We're going to look at it briefly this morning. But this is something that the devil wants to blind people to. The devil would have you believe that you're born to a life of misery, or you're born to a life of happiness. And we understand to a certain degree, all of us, we have our personalities, different types. But your type of personality doesn't mean you have to be a loser. It doesn't mean you have to walk through life in misery. The man who is so quiet that a mouse is louder than he is can have great joy and happiness and contentment in his heart. And that man is so boisterous, he's so outgoing. You say, well, he's such a jolly person. He meets everybody. He just, every day is a sunshiny day in his life. Well, he can have true happiness and joy. And a lot of times, people that are boisterous, you know this is true, that every day is a sunny day, but really, when you really know them, all of that's outward. It's only skin deep. It's only an appearance. That in reality, everything's not as great as they want you to say it is. If you're really close, I think it is, as they say it is. When you're really close, you realize that outward person, if you're uptight with them, you say, that person that seems so overjoyed, really, she's not, or really, he's not. But regardless of the personality type, your basic nature is to, how you appear to others. The truth is that happiness is connected very much to your actions, very much to your doings. We're trying to resolve it. We speak in our culture of depression, and depression is another word for just deep unhappiness. And I think sometimes if we could define it that way, we could begin to find some help for it more so. And people have sought to explain it. They say, well, you're unhappy because of your raising. And certainly a lot of problems in life trace back to our raising. But listen, as you grow up, you can begin to make choices and decisions that overcome the past. You're not cursed to what your mother and dad were. And really, to blame where you are on the past does not resolve where you are. You see, what I want is, how can I change today? I don't really want to spend months in a man's room on his chair, deciphering month after month, year after year, maybe what my dad did that has affected my personality. And I really don't want to do that. What I would like to do is somebody to say to me, listen, you're 50 years old. Now, if you'll take these steps in life, your life will be different. Your life will be changed. Because that's really what I want. I want to change my circumstance. I want to change my experience. Isn't that what I want? And then there are those that say, well, your problem is a physical problem. Your great unhappiness, you were born with a defect. You're born with something, you're missing something. And what we need to do is, you have to be on drugs the rest of your life. And that's really how America is treating its unhappiness today. And it's a dangerous thing sometimes, because a person gets off that medicine and all of a sudden, and this happened just recently, in case I'm aware of, David told me about it, and we went to the particular funeral where a man had got off his medicine. And all of a sudden, here he's killed his father-in-law and kills himself. He's off his medicine. And that's a tragic thing. But here, the psalmist is treating happiness and bliss as a result of your doing, as a result of your action. That he looks at a man whose actions are a certain way, and he says, you know, this man, he's such a blessed man. He's such a happy man. There's a bliss in his life. And then he looks at that life and he realizes, there's certain things true about this life. There's certain things that are true about this man. And I think the truth is, if we emulate that, as we begin to look at that, we follow that, we begin to see some real changes in our own life. That we will be people who are, we can say, are blessed people. Notice he puts it in a negative and then he puts it in a positive. He says of this particular person, that this person, first, he does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly. Second, he doesn't stand in the path of sinners. And third, he doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful. Now, there's a very important about this man, what he says about this man. He deals with a man's conduct. He deals with a man's associations. He deals with the man, the influence of people upon his thinking. Now, when he says he does not walk in the counsel of the ungodly, what you have to understand about this, that the idea of walking is in the Bible is the idea of conduct. It's the idea of life, lifestyle. It's a behavior. In other words, when you talk about the walk of a Christian, you're talking about the way a Christian lives, the way he conducts himself, the behavior in life. And what he says about this man is he does not conduct his life or follow according to the counsel of the ungodly. Now, the word ungodly is most often translated by the word wicked. And we know that in the New Testament, when the Bible speaks about the ungodly, it speaks about the irreverent, the impious. That the ungodly, according to the New Testament, is a person who lives without thought of God. He lives without respect to God. A pious person is a reverent person. And all that means is that as a man lives, he lives with a conscious awareness of the eye of God and the approval of God. He seeks to live to please God. That's the desire of his life. Now, while irreverent isn't the meaning of this word, it is always at the root of wickedness. It is always at the root of wickedness that a man does not live as aware to please God. He does not live as a man who wants to or seeks to be conscious of the eye of God upon his life. And so the wicked, we go further, is hostile to God. Now, this is something that our generation does not want to face. We don't want to believe this. We've been so influenced by the philosophy that people are basically good. And people talk about loving God. But what the Bible says is that people are actually hostile to God. What the Bible teaches is that people are actually at enmity with God. That people actually hate God. Do you know that that's what Jesus taught? Jesus said to the people, he said it in the Gospels, but in particularly in John, he said, they hate me. The people hate me. Now, you think, well, everybody loves Jesus. No. And he said, they hate me because I testify that their deeds, their conduct is evil. And so they were hostile to Jesus. And finally, they placed him upon a cross. People are hostile. And I can tell you how you find out. You start talking to them about what the Bible says and bring them to take responsibility for their actions. I find that a lot of times parents are hostile. We have in our time, we're unwilling to accept responsibility for our own children. And so when you begin to talk to people about their children and their children's lack of discipline, the attitude the children have to others of authority and such, people take great offense. And when I was a boy, if you talked, for instance, if the school teacher were to call home about me, I would be disciplined at home. My parents automatically would say, my son, he's disobeying at home. They didn't turn on the teacher, but that's how it is today. And it's the same way in the church, in the youth program, in the Sunday school programs. Rather than deal with things, we turn. We find there's a great deal of hostility. But there's especially this hostility in our world. When you begin to speak out against the issues of our time. You take the whole issue of gay marriage that's taking place. And brothers and sisters, is there anything that ought to cause you to pray for this nation? I'm going to tell you, we're going to pay a price for our boldness and brassness in the face of God. Do you realize we've got a transvestite, I think that's how you say the word, having a baby? And they're glorying and showing the picture of this man pregnant. As if that's something to hold up instead of something to be ashamed of. And I say to myself, here you have something that's sick. A man with a beard that's pregnant. You say, how can that be? Well, it's a woman. You know it's a woman. But that's a nation that's in defiance of God. Do you know in Canada right now, People arrested for speaking out against that behavior. And people are living, they're wondering, well, I wonder if my son or daughter is gay or not. That's the philosophy of this world. It's made good parents wonder about that. No, they're not gay. Raise them up and teach them how it's evil and it's against God and teach them the right way. But I'm telling you, the world is hostile. The world is that's what it means to be wicked. But here is the council. They're ready to tell us, to show us how we ought to live. Have you ever thought about, by the way, let me say this. Have you ever thought about the intolerance of the tolerant group? They're always crying out for tolerance, but they're intolerant. They're intolerant of of allowing free speech that addresses the evil. You know, we are for tolerance in the sense of free speech. We don't like what a man like Louis Farrakhan says, but we accept that in America he has the freedom to say it. And we don't agree with everything that's said, but we allow. And we feel like if truth can be openly debated, people will be converted to the truth. The truth that man is meant to recognize truth, and the Spirit of God opens his eyes to truth. And what is the chaff to the wheat, as the prophet Jeremiah was asked? What is, let the false prophet speak. Let him speak, but then speak the truth. The truth will win. But this world is intolerant. It hates the Bible. It hates the commandments. Christianity is the most hated religion in America. You can rest assured of that. Islam is going to be protected. Our leader is going to talk about what a great religion it is, in spite of its history, by the way, that it is advanced by the sword, not freedom of speech. And the countries they control, they refuse to let the truth, the gospel, in. No, there's no freedom in that. It's not a great religion. Christianity is the most persecuted of all religions in America. And across the world, it's that way. Why? Because it is the truth and there is a hostility to the truth. But what he's saying right here, the blessed man is the man who refuses to let the world and its wickedness influence his conduct. That he's not going to live the way the world lives. He's not going to live the way people who are hostile to God live. Now, it's interesting, he uses the word counsel. Because the wicked are not silent. Have you ever noticed that and paid much attention to it? Christians are silent. We're silent, we're resistant to state openly what we believe is the truth. In fact, we get nervous when the preacher gets close to it. We really get nervous when it gets down to where rubber meets the road. But we never get angry about anything else. I was watching something on the internet about the replay of the last great golf tournament. And I watched one of the great golfers take God's name in vain. And I shut it off. I said, I'm not watching that. I've admired his golf, but I'm not going to sit and watch God's name being taken in vain. I don't love golf that much, and I don't love him that much. It's just, I'm not going to listen to it. Well, I'm just saying, the world is very bold. They don't hesitate to take your God's name in vain. Those that were commenting on the great golf tournament, they didn't bleep it. As far as I could tell, they didn't even apologize for it. That the American viewers watch this man take God's name in vain very vocally and forcefully. I'm just saying, they don't care. They will speak what they want and do what they want. The world will. But we have become so timid But the reality is that we like living like they do. And it is no wonder that so many people who call themselves Christians are unhappy. Because you will never be happy in the counsel of the ungodly. You will never find the bliss and the peace that the Bible speaks about living according to the counsel of the ungodly. Now, I say the word counsel is interesting. It's interesting for this reason. Because what it points to is the outspokenness of the world. What it speaks to is that they're ready to talk and tell you what they think. That they're ready to share their advice with you. The world is outspoken about what it thinks. There is always the counsel. You take the media. The world is so influential through the media. And people do not realize. Media is a means of communicating philosophy or belief. Entertainment is always a means. Listen to me. Please listen to me. Entertainment is not merely entertainment. Entertainment is always a means to an end. There is always underlying a philosophy, a belief, a thought, an influence. That's why television has been one of the most powerfully destructive tools to truth and to family life and to youth that's ever been. The philosophy is there, but we don't see it. I'll give you an illustration from the world of books. Have you ever read the book Shepherd of the Hills? Don't raise your hand. Shepherd of the Hills is a classic book. I have read that book at least twice, probably three times. How I found out about that book is interesting. My grandfather, I never consider him a book reader, but he read that book. In fact, he asked me years and years ago, have you ever heard about a book called Shepherd of the Hills? I said, no, Grandpa, I never have. He said, I want to get a hold of it. He said, my father used to read us that book when we were boys. And I thought, well, I'll find it for him. And through the course of time, I found it. Of course, it's easily found. And I read it myself. My first reading was, you know, this is an interesting book. It's really well developed in thought. In other words, the plot, no, you can't figure it out till you get to the end. He's a real mystery writer. And there was nothing in it that wasn't clean and upright. There was no trash, no filth. You didn't have to put it down for words and innuendos and things like that. And so I was quite a bit younger than I am now. And I determined, I'm going to read some more books by this author. I'm going to find out more about this author. And so I began to go to the library. First of all, I noticed in some of his other books, language began to come in. Words. But after reading two or three of the books, I noticed a dominant underlying theme in this man's writing. It became clear to me that it was in all of these books. I'd read several of them. And then it became clear to me as I read the other books that the same theme was in the Shepherd of the Hills. And then I found out that the man who wrote the book was not a God-fearing, upright preacher, minister of the word, but a liberal, a denier of truth, as it were. And I began to realize the underlying thought under these books. Every time tradition, solid Christianity was put in a bad light. Church going and church ties, that wasn't what they wanted to present. And it was the social gospel that was held up. And the church that preached this true gospel was caricatured. That was underlying. What I'm saying is thus. That's just an example. Books. Books is part of media, I think. You would fall into that category. But without realizing it, as you read books, those books, the writer of that book is not merely entertaining you. There is a philosophy that she or he has. And the mode of communicating that philosophy is in those books. And without realizing it, the counsel of the ungodly, we're being affected by it, because I could dare say probably in this room today, a good portion of you are regular readers. You've determined primetime TV is filth. That's not to say there aren't some good things on cable. I'm sure there are. But primetime, basically your main channels, you know the stuff that's on there. And so the natural thing then is we're going to be readers. But the problem, if you're not careful, you don't know who you're reading and what is their real philosophy. And without knowing it, they begin to change the way you think. The effect, the counsel of the ungodly. And I think, I say that about books. And I've read a lot of Christian fiction. And I haven't read fiction in a long time. I'm busy with other things, for sure. But I read all the time. That's if you should ask me my hobby, I'm a reader. You can't hardly go anywhere where I am and recognize that there's not books laying around. And many of you are like that. But I'm just trying to say to you, be very careful. I've watched this, even in Christian school movement. I've watched people take books from cults like Seventh-day Adventist or Mormonism. And without knowing it, the woman of the house that is teaching the children, she's found some nuggets of truth in some of these books, but she don't realize that the author is from where he or she is. And they don't have maybe the training in the Bible or the broad knowledge of the truth. And in those books that are Christian school books, you say, well, they're good books. But underlying it is the Mormonism or the Adventism. Maybe the Jehovah's Witness. The cultism is there. And without you knowing it, it's changing the way you think. The media and television, the counsel of the ungodly, there's no question, you know about that. I think we do. I hope that you do. I hope all of us understand that the person who writes a script, you say, preacher, it's just a sitcom. No, it's not just a sitcom. No man, let's back up and let's admit this much. It is impossible for a man or a woman to write something without who they are influencing that. I'm willing to stand here and confess to you that it is impossible for me to preach a text like Psalm 1 without who I am and what I believe affecting how that's preached. And I'll just lie to you to tell you no. Everything that I am comes into what I think about Psalm 1. And when a person writes a movie and a person does a sitcom, that comes in. It's especially true in our talk show hosts. It's true in our roundtable discussions on television and so forth. The counsel of the ungodly. So watching one of the political discussions about 3 or 4 or 5 weeks ago, before Tim Russert died, And it was interesting because it was all about the politicians and their church and how that's influencing. And you know, if you know anything about this campaign, that it's come in big. But what really came across big is these intellectual, political talkers that they felt we'd all be better off without religion as a factor at all. And if you were watching, you couldn't help but realize their idea of running this country is we're better off. Let's forget about religion. So I'd like to hear the man, this man doesn't even go to church. And they say that open. And I'm just trying to tell you, through media, the council comes in. Through education, it's the council of the ungodly. Do you know the big thing right here in this church? I find that when I seek to try to teach people what the Bible says about rearing children, that I'm up against it. And this is a conservative Bible preaching church. When you talk about disciplining children, and the Bible teaches it, but our educators know better. And teenagers and the educators know better. And the council has come in. We could spend a long time on that, but it is through education. The philosophy of the world has been pretty much instilled in the generation that's raising our children and the generation that's running our country. Humanism has been the message in our education system. In other words, evolution, a world without God, a man-centered world instead of a God-centered world. And the council, you want to raise your children, you want them to be raised right. And you have to be concerned. How is the world influencing? How is the world's counsel being given to us? One of the saddest things that's going on in America is found in our higher institutes of learning. And I do not mean the University of Tennessee. I think schools like that are just, if you go on those campuses, if you got any eye open, if your eyes are open at all, you're going to see the world. And you're going to see the hostility toward God and the antagonism toward God. My wife went on that campus that I just mentioned over 32 years ago, looking to go to college there. Spent 1 week in there and knew she was a young Christian lady. She could not maintain the things that she considered right in that environment, and that was no environment for her. I married her respecting her judgment. But I'm not talking about that. I think it's terrible, the tearing down of America on the campuses of this country, the open hostility toward our way of life. But I'm talking about that which calls itself Christian across America. That somehow the counsel of those who are hostile to God have come into those schools. And what's happening is they're training the next generation of preachers. And those preachers are going out into the churches without a reverence for God or for this book. Without a fear of this, what it teaches. And I mean a deep respect for it as the Word of God. But the philosophy, the counsel, it's happened. And it continues to happen. The counsel of the ungodly through the government. Our government leaders. Oh, should we pray for our leaders? I would like to see our president come right out right now and speak with passion and absolute authority to what's going on in California. And I would like to see our president come out with passion against the idea of a transvestite having a baby in this country. And to speak with authority of the need to stop the divorcing and the breaking of our homes. and on and on. That's what I pray I want to see. I want to see those kind of leaders. But our leaders have bought in so often to the counsel of this world. You find them in agreement with the counsel of this world. And you wonder, how can it be? And then I'm just trying to make application to this first point. The influence. How is it that they communicate their philosophies? How is it they communicate their ethics? And they use means, as we say, the media and education and government. But oh, I hope that you understand this. Peer pressure. The significance of the power of peer pressure to mold people into the hostile way the world thinks. If you should ask me why I homeschool my children, my answer would not be, first of all, the curriculum. It's evolutionary in nature, although I cannot abide that. It would not be even that those who stand in front of my class may be an unsaved person, and I don't want my children to be taught by unsaved people. But my big thing, and it affects whether I put my kid in Christian schools, is peer pressure. Peer pressure. It's other children that are influencing the children. That, my friend, there's your trouble. You do all you can. And I know that you can't totally, I hear the argument, you can't totally isolate yourself. I know that. 17 girls in Massachusetts just recently entered into a pact to get pregnant. All but one, 15 years old, one 16. Proud. It's on the news. I wish the president, again, don't you just wish the president was, and I'm not criticizing the president when I say that. I just wish he would. He's got a platform. And I wish he would just, with tears in his eyes, get in front of the country and say, dear friends, this country's got to do something. 17 of our children entered into a pact to get pregnant without marriage, without commitment, without any awareness of what it means. But how did that happen? It happened by peer pressure. Most children become smokers by peer pressure. You take the first puff of a cigarette, it chokes you. But listen, it's always peer pressure that leads a kid to smoke. It's always peer pressure that leads a kid to drink. Did you know? You know that's true. You take the first drink of that sorry smelling stuff and it gags you. Burns going down and feels bad when it hits the bottom. But your friends around you say, boy, that's good. For long, though, you will develop an appetite for it. But it's peer pressure. You want to see the influence of your children? Just go to their closet and see what their dresses and clothes look like. Back when Britney Spears was real young, everyone dressed like she did. And I honestly, every now and then I hear a name, I don't know who the person is, and I'm willing to admit, I'm just out of it. If you say what you, I really don't know who the youth look to today. I don't know. But I do know this, that it's always been the devil puts somebody up here that's more important to them than their preacher is, their youth director is, their mom and dad are. And then moms and dads don't realize it. My child's thinking is being developed by the counsel of the ungodly. I hope that you and I will get out of step with the counsel of the ungodly. Don't buy into it that your child should be able to go out alone with another boy on a date when they're 16, that's an American right. Don't do it. You say, I trust them, and I know that you do, but do you know the passions of just the natural passions of life? Do you know anything about those? Do you remember them? Do you remember the power of them? That's the world. The world is at every turn. If we're going to find the blissful, blessed life, it's going to be separated from that. We're not going to find it. They're going to keep putting their counsel out there. They're not going to be silent. They're going to use every means available because Satan himself is going to make sure they have the avenue to do it. Hollywood's going to help them. The academic people in this world, on many levels, they're going to help them. Everywhere they turn, they get help. And this message is out there. But over against that, the blessed man, he delights in the law of God. We're going to come back to that. The blessed life, this first negative. You can't live like the world lives. You can't live like those who hate God live. You can't think like they live, think and hope to have the blessed life. It just won't happen for you. It won't happen. God has a way. He did not create you to be in misery. He did not create me to be in misery. He created my home to be a happy home. He created my heart to be a happy heart. I've got to get out of their way of living. It isn't working for them, by the way. I wish I had just so much more time to talk about this, but it isn't working for them. It isn't working on the highest levels. It isn't working on the lowest levels. The philosophy of the world, their way of living, they're ready to tell you how to live. But all you have to do is open your eyes. That's all any of us have to do. Open our eyes. When you open your eyes and you look at where they're headed and what they're thinking has led to, you quit looking and envying and say, give me the law of God. Let me delight in it. Stand together.